Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
And no person who is not a capitalist ideologue believes the fundamental myth of capitalism, which is that everyone acting selfishly and attempting to exploit each other makes a functional and stable community where somehow everybody acting selfishly and anti-communally somehow makes a good community.
That's the voice of author and activist Derek Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Derek about the state and nature of the environmental movement and what we need to do as citizens to turn things around.
We're very privileged today to be joined by Derek Jensen. Derek Jensen is a prolific author.
Oh, thank you as always for having me. You always ask such wonderful questions.
Now, in your website, you have a post that says, Earth at Risk, Building a Resistant Movement to Save the Planet. I immediately thought about, what would a resistant movement to save the Earth really look like? And, you know, what are some of the signposts that perhaps we can align ourselves with and say, this is where I can begin?
Well, I think a couple of things. And thank you for asking about a resistance movement, because we desperately need it, because the world's being killed. And the response by even those who want to protect the land is really insufficient, obviously, because otherwise the world wouldn't be being killed. If the response were sufficient, we would be stopping them. And I think also about something a doctor friend of mine always says, which is the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis. Mm. And I think the first step is recognizing that we need a resistance movement. It's like the AA thing, but isn't the first step of the 12 steps, isn't it recognizing that there's a problem? I think it is. You know, Noam Chomsky is probably one of the most important people in exposing U.S. empire over the last 50, 60 years. Is incredibly important, and he's also what some people call a gateway activist, where he's the one who gets us started. And I can't show enough respect for him on that. But then on environmental stuff, he's really bad. And there's a quote that I've been writing about lately where he is saying that there's absolutely no reason, there's no evidence that agriculture is inherently destructive. Mm. And that's just an extraordinary statement. And my point in bringing that up is that he's not alone. Mm. And, you know, a lot of people think that if we can just tweak things a little bit, that things will be okay. But, you know, this culture has been destroying the planet, has been killing the land it's on for thousands of years. And it's made its way across the planet. It's like my friend, the doctor friend, who's also my environmental mentor, he has always said that the reason they can have the timber industry is because there was always another hill that they could, you know, go over the hill and then they would see another valley they could deforest. And they've run out of places to deforest. They've run out of space on the world. There are stolid scientists who are saying that the oceans, to switch from forest to oceans, the oceans could be devoid of fish in 35 years. And the world's falling apart. And the weather patterns have been changing on a larger scale, too, here. Even in 15 years, we've seen a drop down of winter storms that used to be a lot of winter storms where they called it horizontal rain, where it's blowing really hard and raining, and we're not getting so many of those. There's a terrible transition has taken place over the last 20 to 30 years in the environmental movement, where it has become not about saving wild places and wild creatures so much. There are still many who are doing it this way, but I'm talking really about the environmental intelligentsia, mm-hmm. who I just can't stand, mm-hmm. who it's become about sustaining this way of life that's killing the planet. Mm-hmm. It's not about protecting this or that place. Yeah. And, you know, it'd be like being in an abusive relationship and saying we have to do everything we can to make sure that the abuser doesn't lose access to his children.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to, we need to get the children and wife or partner to safety.
I love you for making that connection, because in many ways, your books are always an invitation to look at the world where we are, you know, whether it's your book about deep green resistance, you know, or a language other than words. You make such an eloquent and articulate case for recognizing that we are interdependent, you know, and the life comes from the earth.
Isn't it extraordinary that we actually have to say that out loud?
Yeah.
That life comes from the earth?
Yes.
I mean, where else could it come from? It's just, it's extraordinary to me that the level of disrespect and the level of ungratitude or lack of gratitude and the complete disconnect, it's like, so, you know, so many of the so-called solutions to global warming that are put forward in the mainstream media, it's extraordinary. What do they all have in common? What they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that is completely crazy, because any social system is dependent upon a real world, because without a real world, you don't have any social system whatsoever. You got nothing. You don't have life. It's extraordinary to me. I mean, and everything's happening faster than they say it is, than they expect. So this 35 years for the scientists saying for the oceans to be devoid of fish, it's going to be much sooner. And, you know, it's extraordinary that in our lifetimes, you know, we will see this. And I don't know, do you live near the coast?
Yes, I do.
Where you live, has there been that starfish collapse?
Not only that, right now we are facing a serious threat to the salmon, which are sacred fish to most of the people who live in the Coast Salish coast. I think in many ways, as you say, it's astounding that we have to assert the fact that, you know, all life comes from the earth, that all life depends on our respectful coexistence with the natural world, with the living world, which, you know, includes the fish, includes the ocean, the mountains, the rivers. For me, it's this urgent call to recognize that we're not going to do that by, you know, simply having more bike lanes or, you know, having, you know, some really nice manicure landscapes for people in the Western countries, ignoring the kind of devastation and plundering that takes place in other places like Africa or Latin America
or
Asia or here. Yes, absolutely, or here. In August last year, there was a massive massacre of people, the Marikana massacre in South Africa. Here in Canada in July, we had, you know, the explosion at Lake Megantic, you know, which is now almost but lost, you know, in the history of our consciousness. You know, we people just put it aside. But what does it mean, right? Like this train was going right through the one of the busiest centers, right through Toronto, you know, and it derailed in Lake McGinty. But if it had derailed in Toronto, you know, the thousands of lives that would have been lost, it's inconsequential. When you think about this idea that you posed, you know, how we allow the abuser not only access to the children, but continuous right to continue to be abusing, right? So we haven't changed anything in terms of policies, in terms of, you know, our relationship to creating and maintaining a society that's industrialized, that sees this as our only destiny. So to me, there needs to be a shift in how we imagine, you know, what is possible, how we imagine, you know, what our relationship is with one another and with, you know, the land, which is where we derive our substance, but also our life.
Yes, I completely agree. And it reminds me of a couple of things. That one of them is that after Fukushima, there was one of the Japanese energy ministers said that they couldn't question the use of nuclear energy in Japan because nobody can imagine living without electricity. Mm. And I found that an extraordinary statement because it's pretty typical. It's, you know, Chomsky was basically saying nobody can imagine living without agriculture. And there's a great Supreme Court ruling, great, just and it's very clear, it's terrible, from the 19th century called Johnson v. McIntosh, I believe. And in the Supreme Court ruling, the United States Supreme Court said, it's talking about Indian land ownership, and it said that no matter how unjust it may be to derive ownership from conquest, if that has happened, and if the property of your community is based on that conquest, and if your entire existence there and your community is based on that conquest, quote, it cannot be questioned and becomes the law of the land. And I find that an extraordinarily telling, and all three of those are really the same thing, that there are certain things that we cannot question, and land theft is one of them. That the best we can hope for is that somebody says, oh, well, that happened in the past, and it's been a long time, so now we all just live with it. And, you know, what are the things that we can and can't question? And this ties back to something I'm sure I've mentioned on here before, which is R.D. Lang's three rules of a dysfunctional family. And rule A is don't, and rule A1 is rule A does not exist, and rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence of rules A1 or A2. And what this means is that it's the same thing applied to larger scale. We will not question the production of plastics, the burning. We would rather kill the planet than stop burning oil and gas, we being the larger cultural, not you and me. Lately, I've been writing a lot about this essay by Lewis Mumford where he talked about democratic authoritarian techniques. And a technic is the society that gives rise to and emerges from a technology. The technology doesn't arise in a vacuum. And there are reasons that the Coast Salish did not invent automobiles. And it's not because they were too stupid. It's because their social structure was set up such that they valued different things. And they valued the salmon, for example. And the point is that he broke it into democratic and authoritarian techniques. And there's a couple reasons for this. And a democratic technique would be one that you can control on your own. So anybody can make pottery. So that's a democratic technique. Or a better example is passive solar. Anyone can sit in the sun. And no one can control that unless they build a skyscraper and cut off your access to the sun. But then you can move. And on the other hand, solar photovoltaics require an entire infrastructure to put them together because they require mines. They require, and if they require mines, that means you require forced labor because nobody goes into a mine willingly until their land's been stolen and they've been forced into the wage economy. And it requires transportation infrastructure. It requires an electrical infrastructure. Electrical infrastructures require more mines. Requires the military to take the land. It's an authoritarian technique because it leads to authoritarian social structure. But there's another reason it's authoritarian social structure or authoritarian technique, and that's that the thing itself becomes authoritarian in that the technique and the technology are actually running society, not us. And there's a great example of this. There have been 4 or 5 bans on fracking. Communities in Colorado have attempted to ban fracking, and they've all been overturned by judges saying, there's a couple of them that are still standing, but they're currently they're being sued. But the judges are all saying, you can't ban fracking in your community because fracking is so important to the oil and gas industry. And it's like right there, who's in charge? Or we talk about corporations taking over. What are corporations? Corporations are legal fictions. They're tools. Mm-hmm. Corporations are tools to avoid accountability, frankly, but just focus on the fact that they're tools. We talk all the time about how corporations are running the government. That technology is actually in charge. We have all these science fiction notions of, you know, at some point the machines will take over and then we have to have, well, shoot, they already have, you know, the logic. It's like even though it is killing the planet and even though it is harming the poor, and Chomsky has been a wonderfully dynamic defender of the poor, he still cannot question agriculture. And that's the technology in charge. like here, there's a big fight going on. They want to widen one of the roads coming in because two local businesses want to have bigger trucks come into this community. Everybody else is against it, but it's probably going to happen. I mean, what is money? Money is supposed to be just a medium to facilitate bartering. Mm. And yet people do things for money. You know, money is in charge here. It's taken over how people run their lives. And here we finally get to resistance, that it's not good enough to just say, well, I'm going to be Mr. Zero Money. I'm not going to use money, because that actually doesn't do anything to stop the larger problem. And this is something I've been fighting for decades now, is this notion. It's another way the environmental movement and other movements have gone really crazy, is this belief that, well, I don't know if we've had this particular conversation before, where the 1980s was the first time that the corporate press would use the word consumers to describe people rather than citizens. Mm. And that's really important, because if they can get you to define yourself as a consumer, your choices of resistance are basically buy and not buy, as opposed to citizens can also boycott, they can organize, they can petition, they can have revolutions, they can, you know, grab their pitchforks and storm the castles. They can they can do all sorts of things. And we don't have really an environmental resistance movement. We definitely need one.
When I think about all the isms, right, whether it's imperialism, colonialism, you know, racism, they all have one thing in common, I think, you know, and is that there is this inherent assertion that power over is the world we live in, right? That one has the right to dominate others. We kind of choose the lesser of evil, but still evil. And we've been raised and socialized to accept this as the only option. And just like you said, if you're a consumer, your choice is to buy or not to buy. And so the same way with our environmental movements, if we simply see it as an environmental movement, it creates limitations, because an environment can be many things. You know, it can be a beautifully manicured landscape, right? That's your environment if you live in the north. It could also be a wild forest. And we haven't really taken the time to assert, you know, which one we stand with, in solidarity with, which one we are willing to defend. So,
well, I think it's clear for most people, but most people are going to defend the one that is not wild.
Because I think that the environment has been described as a destination, something that you go to when you're not working.
Well, yeah, a couple things. One is, when you were saying the idea about we've come to accept that it's power over, and I mean, as you know, I've been bashing the whole selfish gene theory and the notion that natural selection is based on ruthless competition for years. And, you know, no person of good heart and no person who is not a capitalist ideologue believes the fundamental myth of capitalism, which is that everyone acting selfishly and attempting to exploit each other makes a functional and stable community, where somehow everybody acting selfishly and anti-communally somehow makes a good community. But, you know, once again, nobody of good heart believes that at this point. And yet that is commonly accepted by people of good heart when it comes to the natural world, that everybody's trying to exploit everybody else, they believe, the whole selfish gene thing. Everybody's trying to exploit everybody else, and somehow that's going to make a stable community. And it's just nonsense, complete crap. That's not how it works. The way the world became so wonderful and beautiful in the first place is by everybody making it so. I mean, how the hell do people think that the world became so rich and fecund and beautiful? The only way it could have is by everybody making it so, by living and dying, not subtracting from it, but adding. And I completely agree with you on your thing about any of those supremacisms, that the problem is not that there are differences. You know, I am obviously different than a dragonfly, and I'm sitting out here watching a dragonfly. And by the way, even 10 years ago, there would have been 50 dragonflies, and now I see two dragonflies right now. There's invertebrate populations are collapsing terribly, terribly. The problem is not recognizing difference. The problem, and this is a fundamental part of patriarchy, it's a fundamental part of racism, any of these supremacisms, human supremacism, the problem is believing that those differences make me superior. Mm-hmm. So you are different than I. And it's always been very clear to me that we should look at those differences as complementary and not as hierarchical, so that you're a woman, I'm a man, and mm-hmm. we need both women and men. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're a woman and I'm a man does not make me superior to you. It makes me different than you. And your skin tone is a different color than mine. And that doesn't make me superior to you. That's just nuts. It makes us, once again, different. And mm-hmm. I wrote something about this in the Human Supremacism book I'm doing on that I think is kind of cute, which is I talk about pancreas supremacists in the body. The pancreas decides it wants to take over the whole body. Mm-hmm. And, like, why does this body need two lungs? It doesn't use them. Yeah. So we need to take over the space for the pancreas. Mm-hmm. And, gosh, it doesn't need that much gray matter. Certainly never uses anyway. So we're going to take over that. And the pancreas decides, it ends up taking over the whole body. And then, of course, the entire body dies. And that's exactly what's happening here. And then one more thing I want to mention about all this that I've been thinking about a lot lately, that there were these people talking about how plants communicate. A few scientists mm-hmm. are finding out that plants, like if caterpillars come and start chewing on this leaf here, then the plant will send out messages that tell other plants that the caterpillars are here and you need to change the composition of your leaves to make them less palatable. And there's one guy who is trying to make and they do this through sending out various chemical messages. And so they have a chemical language instead of a verbal language, oral language, A-U-R-A-L. And one guy is thinking that he's trying to make a dictionary of them to find out, okay, this is when you get attacked by this type, or when you get eaten by this type of caterpillar, this is when there's this other thing. That's 2,500 words and phrases is what he's looking at about. And a lot of plant scientists think that this is complete nonsense because, of course, non-humans can't communicate. Humans are the only ones who have all these special, wonderful, yeah. scrumptious things. That's another thing that Chomsky was saying that was just really hard to take, was that he was saying that he thinks that intelligence is a lethal mutality, that intelligence is what's killing the planet, and intelligence can't survive. Intelligence makes us inherently destructive. And what he's done is the same thing that Richard Dawkins has done. Dawkins says, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command to predict what will happen and when. And what he's doing is he's conflating domination, which is what he's talking about there, with how we know something's true. It's an extraordinary statement. Mm. Just to give a really good example, if I put a gun on you and I say, if you don't jump through a hoop in 3 seconds, I'm going to shoot you, mm-hmm. then you jump through the hoop. You know, I just made matter and energy jump through hoops on command, but don't you think that destroyed our friendship? And it's the same thing with the natural world. And anyway, to go all the way around with this thing, that some of the scientists who were objecting to the notion of non-humans communicate were saying that it's something called teleological. So I started doing a lot of research into teleology, and teleology is basically the question of whether form follows function or function follows form. In terms of evolution, it would be, did we develop eyes so we could see, or can we see because we developed eyes? Mm-hmm. And it's really irrelevant to why plants communicate. It doesn't really matter whether they needed to communicate and figured out how, or whether they were communicating and then they figured out how to listen. It doesn't really matter. But the real point is that there's this other part of teleology, which is that it contains in it the notion, I just found this extraordinary, but it's everywhere, the notion that only human creations have value. And that only human creations have, they even call, say, true function. So a river has no true function. It only has functionality when humans use it. Sure. And that's an extraordinary thing, because if you believe that, what that means is you can take the salmon out of the forest, you can believe you can take the salmon out of the forest, and it won't matter because they have no true functionality. The only true functionality is human functionality. It's like I was looking at this list from the Atlantic Magazine. Atlantic Magazine is just a dreadful magazine. Anyway, I was looking at this list from the Atlantic Magazine of 50 of the greatest achievements of all time. And there were things like antibiotics. But, okay, so I'm going to ask you a trick question here.
Yes.
Who discovered antibiotics? The proper answer that people normally give is Alexander Fleming.
Uh-huh.
So say Alexander Fleming.
Alexander Fleming.
No, that's wrong, actually. Okay, so now let's go back. It's like, actually, there was this French guy, I believe, in the 19th century who discovered that a lot of Arab stable boys working for the military, French military, would keep their saddles in moist areas. And it ends up it was because that helped the horses get over saddle sores. Mm. And it's like, so it was French, it was Arab stable boys. Well, wrong.
I would argue that that's also wrong because you're taking a colonial perspective of who discovered what. You know, indigenous cultures have known for thousands of years how to treat, you know, local diseases, how to keep themselves healthy and in balance.
Of course, of course, of course. I completely agree with that. But that, I'm going to take it further back still. You know who really discovered antibiotics?
Yeah.
Fungus. Because the fungus who created it in the first place.
Yeah.
They're the ones who figured it out. And the reason is because the fungus wanted to make the antibacterial. You know, they got to eat this thing, whatever it was, before the bacteria. It's like, I don't want to give this all to the bacteria. They can eat that over there. I want to eat this. And so I started thinking about, like, the 50 greatest pieces of art, you know, or 50 greatest... You know, I think one of the greatest pieces of art is sunset.
Mm.
And what about the song of a meadowlark? What about a monarch butterfly? What about a dragonfly? Isn't that a beautiful piece of art?
Yeah.
No, it's only the Michelangelo's David, you know? It's like, if humans create it, it can be art. But if the real world creates it, it doesn't count as art. It doesn't count as an achievement.
Yeah.
What about metabolism? Isn't that a great thing? What about proprioception? That's how you know. This weird thing one night where I woke up in the middle of the night and I was going to get a drink of water and I couldn't, and this has only happened to me one night, I couldn't find my mouth with my hand to give myself a glass of water with the lights off. And so I started thinking about that. That's proprioception, is how we know where our body is, where parts of our body are. You know, if you put your hand behind your back, you still know where your hand is. And it's a necessary thing in order to walk, in order to do anything. And what an extraordinary invention. You know, isn't that a cool thing? And what about photosynthesis? Isn't that an amazing invention?
Yeah.
My point is that it's really deeply ingrained in us that if humans create it, it's a big thing.
Mm.
And it's, whoa, this amazing discovery. But if non-humans create it, well, it's no big deal. And it could be replaced, and it's not even true functionality.
Yeah.
I just find that absolutely extraordinary.
Tune in next week for the second half of this interview with Derek Jensen. Thank you, and so long for now.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.